From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston.
It's July 4th, 2011. I'm Marco Werman. Libyan rebels have suffered terribly, but one rebel doctor says the struggle continues.
We have a lot of injured patients. We have a lot of the people died. They are fighting to get freedom and to be live free.
Like American insurgents in our revolution.
What we did was not dissimilar to what the insurgents in Iraq or even the Taliban in Afghanistan were doing over these past several years. In fact, we have to remember that we are on the map. We are a country because we were insurgents.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Zolnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The anti-government uprising in Libya has been raging for more than 4 months, and NATO is carrying out ICE airstrikes against military targets in the North African nation. Still, neither the forces of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi nor the rebels seem to be making much progress. Gaddafi remains in charge of most of the country. The rebels control the eastern third. The closest they've gotten to the capital, Tripoli, is the Nafusa Mountains in the west. The BBC's Mark Doyle is with the rebels there.
We're at a firing point on the edge of the town of Kikla. The forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi are in another town 4 or 5 kilometres away on the horizon called La Gualish, which the rebels say that they want to take. They've been saying that for days now. And the fight for La Gualish is continuing. The rebel forces just fired a single artillery piece, a long tube with a big shell in it that looked like it was a relatively homemade affair on the back of a pickup truck.
And now shells are landing in the position from where they fired that big gun.
One of the shells just landed very close to the position that the rebels were firing from. I can still see the plume of smoke, maybe 50, 100 metres away from where I am now.
Inside. Let's go.
We went back to a road junction a safe distance behind the front line.
Yesterday they tried to advance into Kikla.
Commander Ali El-Hajj, the man in charge of the rebels in this area, speaks through a translator. He's in a gymnasium-turned-resting point for the rebels, studying a map I've opened for him on a ping-pong table. Commander Ali El-Hajj doesn't dress like a soldier. He wears slacks, a T-shirt, and a small sun hat. But he's clearly in charge here and commands the respect of his men, who, in another life, are farmers, engineers and students.
You took most of the mountain in early June, as I understand it. Why is it taking so long to continue to control the rest of the mountain?
The reason being we stopped is because there's a very, very big army. And, I mean, they have a lot of support. And for us, as revolutionaries, we're in short supply of ammunition, that's one thing. Another thing is, basically, also NATO told us not to advance because they have a strategy or something.
As he prepares his troops for battle, I ask Commander Ali El-Hajj for his take on why NATO sometimes tells the rebels not to advance. Sometimes it's a good idea, he says, because when we're on open ground, Gaddafi's long-range heavy weapons threaten us. In the mountains, we're at home, we can advance. But on open ground, Commander Ali El-Hajj says, perhaps NATO is right to be cautious. There's another theory too. Some rebels say that an all-out assault on Tripoli, if the armed opposition could manage that without many heavy weapons of their own, would be a bloody affair with widespread civilian casualties. Most of the rebels wouldn't want that. Many have families there.
We're in the cool of a hospital ward in behind the front line now in the town of Yefren. Yefren Hospital, which now is serving as a military hospital for the injured rebels. I can see in front of me now 1, 2, 3, 4 of the trauma patients. They've been treated, got bandages on their arms and heads where they've received shrapnel.
Lying next to a bank of monitors in an intensive care unit, a critically wounded rebel fighter. The next 72 hours will decide his fate. Two rebels died in the clashes I had a glimpse of earlier. Seven more died the next day. I don't know what casualties Colonel Gaddafi's forces suffered. A doctor arrived, who I'd first met last week. He asked not to be named to protect his relatives in Tripoli. Was this continuing death toll, I asked him, justified?
I think yes. We have a lot of injured patients. We have a lot of the people died. We have a lot of people handcuffed. They are fighting because they have trust in something to get freedom and to be live free. I think it's worth it.
The doctor, I feel sure, was speaking for the farmers and the engineers and the students. They climbed into an open pickup truck and headed back to war.
The BBC's Mark Doyle in Libya. In the West Bank, the Palestinian soccer team competed in its highest-profile home game ever yesterday. The Palestinians played to a 1-1 tie with Afghanistan. That was good enough to send them into the second preliminary qualifying round for the 2014 World Cup. The World's Matthew Bell went to the match and found plenty of enthusiasm for the home team.
The Palestinian national soccer team has been competing internationally for more than a decade, but this was its first World Cup qualifier at home. That's what made Sunday's match against Afghanistan an historic day. The national anthem played, flags waved, and the crowd chanted for Palestine. To many people here, it was more than just a soccer game. Jabril Rajoub is a veteran Palestinian official and the head of the Palestinian Football Federation. Standing on the sidelines before the opening kickoff, Rajoub said this is about building a state.
Through sport, through football, we are making our history for the future of our kids, our sons, and our grandsons.
Admission was free. About 7,000 home team fans showed up at Faisal al-Husseini Stadium in Al-Ram, a Palestinian town just north of Jerusalem. A tall concrete wall divides the town from Israel, and it sits just a couple of hundred yards from the stadium. The year 1934 might seem like ancient history, but that's when a previous incarnation of Team Palestine competed for World Cup glory. It was under the British Mandate, and Jews and Arabs played together on the same team. It's a very different time now, says Atullah Najjar. He's editor-in-chief of a magazine called Palestinian Sport. Palestinian people are struggling for a country of their own, he says, and the national soccer team is a symbol of that struggle. Palestine scored the first goal, but Afghanistan never went away, and the visitors answered with a goal in the second half. The Palestinian fans clapped politely, and the game ended in a 1-1 tie. The Afghan coach, Yusuf Kargar, says he wasn't aware of any Afghan supporters in the crowd. Speaking through a translator after the game, Kargar said, "There's a real advantage when playing in front of your own fans," but he went on to thank his Palestinian hosts.
It's a lovely country, and wherever we go back home, we will tell the people how lovely the country is and how beautiful. There is no fight, and there is peace and love.
For one of the home team players, this trip to the West Bank was an opportunity to visit Palestinian territory for the very first time. Omar Jaroun is a Palestinian-American who grew up in Peachtree, Georgia. He plays professional soccer in Tampa, Florida, and Jaroun said it's a thrill to be part of Palestinian history.
Playing in front of this crowd was unbelievable. They're cheering the whole time. It's just like European football, and they have so much pride, and just awesome to see the you know, just in their face the how happy they are, and it's great. You know, I know these guys, it means more to them than it does to me, and it means a lot to me to play in front of Palestinians.
By advancing past Afghanistan, Palestine, which is ranked 167th out of 203 World Cup contenders, faces Thailand next. None of the fans I spoke with are talking about a miracle in 2014. Not yet, at least. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Al Ram in the West Bank.
We think you'll be impressed by the turnout and the brand-new Palestinian stadium in the West Bank. Matthew sent us a slideshow of the Afghan-Palestinian game. It's at theworld.org. One case against the former chief of the International Monetary Fund, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, is faltering, but another case against him is about to begin. The case that's falling apart involves a hotel maid in New York who charged that Strauss-Kahn forced her to perform oral sex. Prosecutors have expressed doubts about the maid's credibility. The new case has to do with French writer Tristan Bannon, who alleges that Strauss-Kahn tried to rape her 8 years ago. The writer's lawyer said today she'll file a criminal complaint against him tomorrow. Strauss-Kahn then instructed his lawyer to file a counteraction for false accusation. Stephen Erlanger is Paris bureau chief for the New York Times. He says Bannon and her lawyers say they've moved independently of the case in New York.
They tried to keep the case separate, and the lawyer said he didn't want Bannon's case to get wrapped up with the case in New York, and in fact he refused to cooperate with New York prosecutors. But I think she says she was offended at the way the case begins to fall apart and feels herself that she can only now look herself in the mirror if she brings these charges.
Many in France have jumped to the conclusion with the New York case that Strauss-Kahn has done nothing wrong. For the most part, how do French women see it?
Well, there's been a lot that's come out about his behavior outside the courtroom, and he's been described by many people as someone quite interested in sex, with who tries it on with lots of people, who had a lot of affairs, who pushed a lot of people to try to have sex. So even if he is cleared of all charges in New York, I think his reputation has been damaged. There was a lot of elite knowledge about his behavior, but it hadn't come out into the mainstream of France until the New York charges. So even if he's cleared, and many people obviously hope that he'll be cleared, at the same time, I think his own reputation has suffered quite a lot of damage.
You know, another thing that the French have criticized greatly during the whole Strauss-Kahn affair here in the States is the media, what they've called the media lynching of Strauss-Kahn here. But specifically, what has bothered the French about the Strauss-Kahn case here and the so-called media lynching?
Well, people are upset about that. I mean, they also feel that, you know, we're back to the anti-French clichés of the 2003 events when France refused to back George Bush's war in Iraq, and we talked about freedom fries and cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And the New York tabloids certainly have indulged in every French cliché that you can imagine, Le Perve and frog's legs. So I think that's been part of the problem. And they don't have tabloids that are quite the same. Now, the Germans do. Bild is pretty nasty, and the British certainly do. But it's not really in the French culture.
So with headlines like Booty Gall and Frog Legsit, has the DSK affair taken U.S.-French relations to a new breaking point, do you think?
No, but it reawakens old clichés and old feelings of anti-Americanism.
We'll leave it there. Stephen Erlanger, New York Times bureau chief in Paris. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Later, Japanese sushi after the tsunami on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, partnerships, and philanthropy to help change the way the world addresses the global epidemic of chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. More about Medtronic's chronic disease commitment at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's worth noting on this Independence Day that the Declaration in 1776 may have been a little premature. After all, it wasn't until 1783 that the British called it quits. The American Revolution was a model of irregular warfare in which a weak but determined force triumphs over a vastly superior army. It's not surprising, then, that our revolution features in a new book. It's called Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits, How Masters of Irregular Warfare Have Shaped Our World. Author John Arquilla joins us from KAZU in Seaside, California. John, what was irregular about the American Revolution?
Well, at some point, soldiers figured out that George Washington's preference for fighting stand-up battles with the British wasn't going to work. And when Nathanael Greene, a Quaker-turned-general, went south to try to retrieve the situation there, he wrote a letter to Washington saying, "I am going to fight a partisan war in small bands. I will attack the British outposts in the wilderness." And he went about the business of doing this. He did fight some stand-up battles. He lost them all. But his irregulars, his hit-and-run raiders, exhausted the British, eventually putting General Cornwallis on the path to Yorktown, where he was trapped, and the war was won.
Well, we'll talk about Nathanael Greene a bit more in a second, but I just want to clarify what you're talking about here. You're not just talking militiamen hiding behind stone walls and taking pot shots at passing redcoats. You're talking about highly organized, disciplined forces fighting in an irregular manner. I mean, that's guerrilla warfare, isn't it?
Absolutely. Small bands. The best one that Americans know today is Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, had a few hundred followers. He'd break them up into little teams, and they would attack these small British outposts, usually if not too many more soldiers of their own. The British had to disperse their forces because they were trying to protect a friendly population of Tories, those who wanted to remain under the crown. So what we did was not dissimilar to what the insurgents in Iraq or even the Taliban in Afghanistan were doing over these past several years. And in fact, we have to remember that we are on the map. We are a country because we were insurgents. There's the newest country in the world, South Sudan, is going to be a country in 5 days because of its ability to engage in guerrilla warfare.
You're drawing a parallel between the United States of America and South Sudan. That's interesting.
Well, I think any time a people fight for their freedom, they use the methods that are going to work. And in the American Revolution, by 1780, it was pretty clear that our attempts to fight in a straightforward, conventional way were not going to win. This irregular way did work. Now, it's important to say irregular warfare is not just guerrillas, and it's not just terrorists. It's also the use of your standing military forces in small packets, commando units, doing interesting things, striking at pressure points of the opponent.
Now, the man you nominate as the master of irregular warfare in the American Revolution, this Rhode Islander named Nathanael Greene, I doubt many Americans today could tell you much about him, but what made him a master of irregular warfare?
I think first it was because he was self-taught. He didn't come out of the British military establishment. He was a Quaker. In fact, the members of his meeting questioned him closely because he had so many books on strategy in his home library. But he was a very practical guy, and he said, "Look, we're not winning." He had a catastrophe in New York early in the war and very nearly lost the Battle of Monmouth, and he said, you know, we've got to do business in a different way. So he had an openness of mind to doing things in unusual fashion, and this is something that all the masters over the past couple of centuries have had. Generally, they come out of a different kind of background from your traditional soldiers who want to fight in traditional ways, as George Washington did.
Now, another master you cite is George Crook, and I find it fascinating that you draw a parallel between what George Crook did out in the Wild West and the Anbar Awakening in Iraq. Talk about that. Who was George Crook?
Well, he was Nantan Lupan, the Gray Wolf chief, the best American Indian fighter, and he was the best in part because he had a tremendous respect for their culture, the Native American culture, just as the best special operators today are very culturally attuned. And what George Crook did so brilliantly, particularly in Arizona, was he reached out to the very Native Americans who'd been fighting against him, and he said, look, I want you people to have your own place, your own freedom. You don't want us as your overlords. Work with me to bring these renegades in. Crook rode off into the Sonoran Desert with 250 troops, only 50 of them white men, the rest Native Americans, who were persuaded to join this cause. And they defeated Geronimo. And Crook, at one point, after achieving one of his coups against the Apaches, walked by himself into their camp and sat down and engaged Geronimo and his braves in a discussion. Mm. And he got them to agree to come in. And they did. It's a remarkable, remarkable success. And the Anbar Awakening reached out to those who had been fighting us, got them to switch sides and turn that war around. Things aren't perfect over there, but the violence went down by about 90% after we did this. Right now, General Petraeus is trying to do this in Afghanistan. George Crook should be something of a patron saint of this kind of tactic.
You also discuss Osama bin Laden in your book, but he's not on your list of masters of irregular warfare. Should he be, though? I mean, after all, he employed small units in innovative ways, and he certainly shaped our world.
Osama was very good at building networks. The small band of fighters in a network is clearly the key organizational development in conflict. He did that very well, but he didn't have a capacity for what I call swarming, that is, to mount more attacks. General Jopp, for example, would mount offensive with attacks all over Vietnam at the same time. Bin Laden was only able to orchestrate a few major acts and a few smaller campaigns at any time, so he doesn't rise to the level of mastery because of that. We, on the other hand, can do swarming very well. There are probably half a dozen night raids every single night in Afghanistan, and still in Iraq, quite a frequent practice. So we can hit many places at once. What we don't do is network very well. That's why an American, General Petraeus probably comes closest, and maybe the historical record will judge him a master one day. But so far, we're still much too traditionally organized, so we don't take advantage of our great capacity to strike in many places.
What are the key lessons that students of war should learn from the masters of irregular warfare?
I think they should learn, particularly the message I try to get through to our officers, is that often less is more. When we talk about, for example, we have Senator McCain today saying that the drawdown from Afghanistan is too steep. Well, what we have to remember is George Crook going out in the desert with 250 soldiers. We have to remember our own 11 Special Forces A teams a decade ago, just 200 soldiers toppling the Taliban from power. We don't always need 150 or 200,000 troops, and that's a mindset that we have to get our military out of, particularly in these times. We have to reduce our defense budget, but if we believe we need to be keeping over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan and spending $2 billion a week, well, you know, we're going to bankrupt ourselves and not get the job done. And by the way, the more forces you have, as some of the masters in my book point out, the larger the force, the greater its vulnerability to disruption. The bigger you are, the bigger a target you are. So we need to think smaller. We've got to be smaller, quicker, and closer to the opponent.
Certainly does make you think. John Arquilla teaches at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and is author of a new book called Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits, How Masters of Irregular Warfare Have Shaped Our World. John, thank you very much.
A pleasure, Marco.
News headlines from around the world are next on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead, Japan's latest rock star wows them in Los Angeles.
I always like listen to Vocaloid music, and I always thought that she was like the cutest out of the bunch. Even though there's other characters that I'm in love with, she's the one that stands out more that I really like.
That's right, Vocaloid music sung by a hologram.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Deanie Solnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The former Prime Minister of Thailand was ousted in a military coup 5 years ago, but Thaksin Shinawat was not forgotten, quite the contrary. Thaksin's supporters retain their passion for his populist policies. His enemies remember the Thai leader for his authoritarianism. Thaksin remains in exile in Dubai, but yesterday his party won a majority in Thailand's general election, and his youngest sister, Yingluck Shinawat, will be the next prime minister. Reporter Erwin Loy is in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand. Erwin, what and who do Yingluck Shinawat and her Pua Thai party represent?
Well, they represent what up until now had been the opposition here in Thailand, a very angry opposition, you could say. The Pua Thai Party is backed by the Red Shirts. You may remember last year there were the massive protests in Bangkok by people wearing a lot of red shirts, and that's what they came to be known as. They were basically protesting against the government of the day, which lost in Sunday's election. And they're largely loyal to Yingluck's brother, Thaksin Shinawat, who is the prime minister of Thailand, basically for the first part of this decade until he was ousted in a coup in 2006.
Right. Well, having been overthrown in a military coup in 2006, will the military in Thailand now accept his sister's government, or is she, in their eyes, simply new fruit from a poison Shinawat tree?
Well, I guess that's a question that remains to be seen. Right now, everyone is saying the right things in terms of, you know, building peace in this country. Right now, the military is saying, the army chief is saying that he's going to not comment on any of the political issues involving this new government, which is, to be fair, a bit of a change from him because he was, throughout the campaign before July 3rd, he was actually saying quite a few things that were disguised but fairly obvious. You know, he was talking about asking the voters to remember what happened in terms of political violence. He's asking them to vote for the good people. And everyone here knows that the military is aligned with the establishment, which does not include the Red Shirts and Yingluck Shinawat's Pua Thai Party.
Right. Well, who is the constituency of the Pua Thai Party? It's got to be more than just those people in red shirts.
Definitely. Generally speaking, this all goes back to Thaksin Shinawat, the former prime minister and Yingluck's brother. He came to power on the backs of very populist policies. We're talking about universal health care, very strong subsidies for farmers. And this really endeared him to the rural and urban poor here. So those are largely the type of people who still support Thaksin Shinawat and, by extension, his sister. Last night I was at a celebration of sorts for supporters of Pua Thai, and to a man and woman, everyone was talking about what this would mean for their lives. They all identified as lower income or poor people, and they said this was really a good thing for them, this victory for the Pua Thai Party. So whether or not that's actually true, the image of Thaksin and his populist policies is very much associated with his sister.
So it sounds like the rural poor like his sister, like the Pua Thai Party. How divisive, though, is the figure of Thaksin Shinawat still? Does it bode well for Thaksin's future in Thai politics with his sister in power now?
That's the million-dollar question here. Pua Thai and Yingluck Shinawat as prime minister is widely expected to push for amnesty for certain political figures, and that would include Thaksin Shinawat. But he's such a controversial figure. While he's well-loved by the urban and rural poor here, he's really an offensive character to many of the elite here, the middle and upper class. So the question is whether or not he will be allowed to return. If his sister pushes for amnesty for Thaksin, there will be some sort of protest, undoubtedly. Whether or not that will end up toppling a government remains to be seen. In the past, there have been protests against Thaksin. And each time, the military did not really step in to remove those protesters. Those were the ones known as yellow shirts. Whereas last year, when the red shirts protest, the army did step in to remove them, and it, in fact, saved the government of the day until the election that happened on Sunday. So whether or not Thaksin is given an opportunity to return, and whether or not the army steps in, those are the major questions that will determine whether or not the current government will survive into the future.
Reporter Erwin Loy in Chiang Mai, northern Thailand. Thanks very much for your time, Erwin.
Thanks, Marco.
Shortly after the March 11th earthquake in Japan, we began hearing reports about sushi panic. Not from Japan, but from New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. After the quake, sushi lovers in those cities were rushing out to eat raw fish before it was too late. Many of them speculated the radiation from the Fukushima nuclear plant would contaminate the sea, the fish, and then people. That's not an impossible scenario, but it's highly unlikely. Still, since March 11th, the sushi industry in Japan has been in disarray. If you want to know about sushi, Narita Yoshitaka is your guy. He's the man widely credited with streamlining Japan's sushi industry. The 54-year-old entrepreneur runs Tsukiji Sushi Co. It's named after Tokyo's world-famous Tsukiji Fish Market, where he sources the majority of his produce.
Tsukiji Sushi Co. Narita-san
told me that the Tsukiji Fish Market is called the Kitchen of Japan. It's the country's biggest fish market that also makes it the world's biggest. Every day, buyers from around the globe also shop at Tsukiji. A Japanese horse mackerel sold in Tsukiji in the morning could be in a New York sushi bar that night. The morning I went to Tsukiji, it was raining but still busy. This fishmonger, whose voice was hoarse from barking out to customers, deals exclusively in sushi-quality tuna. He had neat cuts of tuna laid out in a glass case that looked more like a museum display than a refrigerator.
So I'd just like to know how concerned your customers are about where their fish comes from now with the radiation scare.
A lot, he said. Right after March 11th, he said, business dropped off by about 50%. Now it's only down about 30%. Elsewhere in the Tsukiji market, business also seemed to be picking up. Saito Yoshiaki is 60 and runs the Saito Fish Company. He's been in the business for 40 years. After March 11th, Yoshiaki told me business was down sharply, but he said that was because of logistical problems. There was no gas, roads were shut down, but over time, business came back. He said that his customers have faith that the Japanese government is inspecting all the fish sold in the market to make sure it's not contaminated.
The ocean is so huge in terms of the amount of water in the ocean that any radioactivity in the ocean gets enormously diluted just by the amount of water in the ocean.
David Brenner is the director at Columbia University's Center for Radiological Research.
And so the amount which might reach one through fish is actually very, very small. It's more of an issue for the local rivers and streams near the Fukushima plant.
That radioactive water could contaminate freshwater fish. It could also, and has, contaminated crops.
Things like broccoli, cauliflower, turnips, mushrooms. They're actually the majority of the foods in Japan that are still slightly radioactive. And again, only the ones that are being grown in the northeast of Japan, near Fukushima.
Still, the idea that fish from the sea might catch radiation, like a cold, and pass it on to humans through sushi is a powerful scenario that's hard to ignore. And as a result, the sushi business continues to suffer. Back to our man Narita Yoshitaka of Tsukiji Sushi Co. It will take a long time for the sushi business to go back to normal, he said. And it's not just because fish stocks have gone down. The export side of the business has almost been paralyzed, he said. And people's confusion about radiation isn't changing. It's easy to understand why radiation continues to scare people. The number of cancer deaths attributed to the Chernobyl disaster range from zero to tens of thousands. It's the uncertainty of radiation's effects that's most worrying for David Brenner of Columbia University.
It's not people getting a high dose of radiation from eating a piece of highly contaminated fish. It's large numbers of people getting very small amounts of radiation from eating food which is way below the regulatory levels in terms of contamination over a generation or two is really the long-term issue that we face from Fukushima. And the reality of the situation is that we don't really know what the long-term health consequences of that are going to be.
The immediate consequences for the Japanese fish diet, sushi especially, are also hard to analyze. Sushi is already in the crosshairs. Consumers of tuna are warned about mercury levels. And in this age of eating locally, raw and often exotic fish from far-flung parts of the world isn't the most sustainable food choice. So sushi experts like Narita Yoshitaka are concerned about the future of brand sushi. Still, if you're in Japan, go to the Tsukiji fish market. You won't regret it.
So I had a very small breakfast, but they've got eel kebabs and teriyaki, and it is so good. It's just smooth. It's slippery. It's nothing like any eel that you get in sushi places in the States. Arigato.
Eat your heart out, all you July 4th burger and dog eaters. If you want to see some of the produce in the Tsukiji fish market, I've got some mouth-watering pictures at theworld.org. For our GeoQuiz now, we're looking for a South American country. Its music and rich folk life may not be as well known as its history of drug cartels and violence, but it's the folk life that's on display this week on the National Mall in Washington. More than 100 artists and performers traveled north to be part of the ongoing Smithsonian Folklife Festival. So can you name this country that borders the Pacific and grows some of the world's finest coffee beans? The good news is you don't have to wait too long for today's answer. Olivia Cadaval is a curator at the Smithsonian Museum. So you invited musicians, potters, woodcarvers, and others to demonstrate their crafts. Tell us what country they represent and how you came up with this diverse mix for the Folklife Festival.
The country we represent is Colombia. And this is a project that we have been doing field research, ethnographic research, for over 3 years. So it's just very exciting to have our Colombianos here to engage the public in knowing the Colombia beyond what obviously sometimes people think, which is not quite the case anymore, is violence,
right,
drugs.
So Colombia is the answer to our GeoQuiz. Now, I understand you're highlighting Colombia's coffee-growing regions. What part of the country is that, and have you been there?
Oh, absolutely. The Andes sort of end in Colombia, and the coffee region is in the central range of the Andean Mountains. We have everything around coffee. We have the baskets that they use for picking the coffee and selling it. So that's a whole basket tradition. And, of course, in the kitchen, we are making some incredible frijoles, which are typical of the coffee area.
And let's talk about that coffee a second. Is it prepared or served in any special way in Colombia?
You know, Colombianos drink coffee at all hours of the day. For breakfast, you will have your café con leche. So this is your coffee and milk. And then during the day, and then you have the tradition of the onces meaning 11 o'clock, so that's time for a snack. And you have your tintico. The tintico is a smaller cup of coffee. You may break it with a drop of milk, lots of sugar. So you have your coffee at all hours and in different sizes of cups depending of what the occasion is.
What other traditional food and flavors of Colombia can you get at the Folklife Festival? You mentioned the frijoles.
Well, let's say with the frijoles, we have several ethnic groups from the Amazon, and they are making from scratch the cassava bread. This is made with a yuca. You know, first they peel, they grate, then they double strain, and then we have an open fire where they're making these huge flatbreads of cassava, which of course goes with the caldo tucupi, which is with a fish soup. We have a candy maker, and she does this decorative candy. You know, on and on. We have great diversity of what Colombia really is.
Now, the fast food that really blew me away in Bogota was a deep-fried sausage laid down in an arepa, this fermented tortilla. It was so good. You going to have any of that?
Oh, my goodness. You just hit it on the head, the nail on the head. The arepa is the tortilla of Colombia, and it is made with either corn, sometimes wheat still, depending on the region, and also with cheese.
So, Olivia, you know, if the movie Scarface gave us that enduring negative image of Colombia, do you think that an afternoon with the arts, food, and music of Colombia can reorient Americans to a different image of the country?
Well, you know, it's very interesting you bring that up, because I've been watching over the last 4 days, and there are these face-to-face exchanges. And you have a family from Iowa talking to the farmers from Boyacá and actually comparing some of the traditions they have there. Also, I think what happens is that for the public that has been coming, and I think now we're almost getting to 500,000, they are meeting people face to face and finding out the depth of the tradition. You have jewelry makers, women pan for gold. I mean, there's lots of life going on in Colombia that is not based on violence, that is not based on drugs. We're way past that.
Well, we've got a clip of some traditional joropo-style music. This joropo music is obviously going to be performed at the Folklife Festival, I assume.
Well, joropo music is very interesting. I mean, this is the music from the plains. The songs all relate to life on the plains, life with the cattle. And in fact, you do have the lead cowboy. He sings to the cattle. If he's not a good singer, he's not going to be a good leader.
Olivia Cadaval, a folklorist and curator at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, going on now in Washington. Thank you very much, Olivia.
Thank you, and come visit.
Just ahead, two treasures, one real, one man-made on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's a story involving treasure that caught our eye today. The treasure of silver and gold was discovered in a secret underground chamber in a temple in the southern Indian state of Kerala. It's generating bold headlines in the local Hindu newspaper there. G. Mahadevan is a senior journalist there. Describe for us the treasure and the temple where it's been long lost.
Well, Marco, the temple is located in the city called Thiruvananthapuram. It is in the southwestern corner of India. The name of the temple is Sri Padmanabha Swami Temple, and the presiding deity here is Mahavishnu, the god that preserves the universe. And they had to go down to an underground chamber to get at this treasure, which first appeared like mud, you know, it's sand. So they brought it up in sacks, and then when they sifted through that, out came golden chains, golden crowns, rubies, emeralds, cat's eyes, and you name it, including Belgium diamonds. So though it was always known that the Padmanabha Swami temple contained a little bit of treasure, the sheer scope and variety of the articles found was astonishing, to put it mildly.
It sounds pretty extraordinary, but there are a lot of mysteries here. No one really knows how much it's worth yet, how it got there, or who it originally belonged to. How will this mystery be solved?
Well, I mean, there isn't much of a mystery regarding how it got there, because And Thiruvananthapuram also happened to be the capital of the kingdom of Travancore. So the kings of Travancore, they ruled as representatives of the Padmanabha Swami, who is the main deity of the temple. This treasure was built up over centuries. These were partly offerings, the riches that were presented to the Maharaja of Travancore by other kings of India. So all these years, the royal family, they built up this treasure and they guarded this treasure.
Whether the treasure is worth millions or billions, it's got to be generating a lot of attention and buzz in Kerala. Are police out trying to protect people from getting any glimpse of it whatsoever?
Yeah, absolutely, you bet, because this temple is a large complex, and at any point of time, even if there are hundreds of people praying inside, it's very, very quiet. And this sleepy little temple has suddenly now become a security concern. You have armed policemen patrolling, because now the word is out that there are billions beneath the temple. So, I mean, this has generated a huge, huge interest in the local people and indeed worldwide.
Any chance at all of getting an up-close and personal look at this treasure?
No, nobody's allowed in. No journalist, no member of the public, as far as I know, has seen this treasure. And before the people could get in and get the treasure out, they had to first go in and pump oxygen into this chamber. It has supposedly not been opened for more than a century now.
I would love to have been present when they opened. And even if there's nothing inside, I just want to see how they do it.
I know.
G. Mahadevan is a senior journalist for the Hindu newspaper in
Thiruvananthapuram,
capital of the southern Indian state of Kerala. Mahadevan, thank you very much for your time indeed.
Oh, pleasure was mine, Marco.
One of the hottest tickets in Los Angeles this weekend was a concert by a Japanese pop culture icon. Her name is Hatsune Miku. Her sold-out show, Mikunopolis, marked her debut in the U.S. Reporter Kori Takahashi has this report about the computer-generated pop star.
Hours before Hatsune Miku's show, thousands jockey outside the Nokia Theater to be the first inside. Elizabeth Lopez came with her family from Chihuahua, Mexico. She's a Miku super fan. You can tell from Lopez's turquoise wig and makeup. It's an homage to Miku style, a teen trifecta of technology, anime, and Japanese pop lyrics.
It's also about the Miku, like falling in love. I'm the biggest fan. Can't wait.
Now, if cute and catchy is your thing, it shouldn't be any surprise why Miku connects with teens in the viral web. She's over the top, in every way, starting with her trademark turquoise hair, color-coordinated outfits, and voice that sounds like a caffeinated chipmunk. But here's the twist. Miku's a virtual singer whose only appearance on stage is as a lifelike 3D hologram. She's what's called a Vocaloid, basically the consumer-friendly interface for voice synthesizing software. Another fan, Bridget Ramirez, explains.
You just basically like write what you want and adjust the settings to where you could make your own character, like your own Vocaloid. I always like listen to Vocaloid music, and I always thought that she was like the cutest out of the bunch. Even though there's other characters that I'm in love with, she's the one that stands out more that I really like.
In Japan, Hideki Kenmochi developed Vocaloid at the Yamaha Corporation. You've typed in the lyrics, and now that you've typed in the lyrics, let's hear how that sounds.
It sounds like this.
Happy birthday to you.
Other companies create characters, like Miku, that give the Vocaloid technology a more human range. Their voice libraries and Miku shot to fame because fans and even some professional Japanese artists popularized her sound library by using software to create songs and videos that went viral.
In the past, we needed singer for song, but using Vocaloid, we don't need singer. So we can perceive the creator's emotion or the creator's music directly.
The process does for singing what a keyboard synthesizer does for pianos. In the Vocaloid scene, this means a gifted songwriter may not have to rely as much on their own pipes. But if I could write good music and compose good music, I could kind of be a star with this, right?
Yes, exactly.
So far, despite the sold-out concert in LA, the Vocaloid style is still an acquired taste.
According to our research, 8% of female teenagers listen to only Vocaloid music. That's amazing statistics.
Miku's concert, which featured guest appearances from other Vocaloids, wasn't all digital all the time. Her bandmates were human, and the wardrobe-changing 3D Miku was happy to give them shout-outs. The show was the highlight of Anime Expo, which ends today. Anime Expo's Mark Perez helped bring the concert to the U.S.
So Miku's really a creation of the fans. The software application that was put out by Yamaha provides a medium or a forum for people to create, give her life. But it's really the fans, the people that use that software to create songs and to give her life, that have created who she is and given her a soul.
And maybe that explains why the crowd wasn't just young anime fanatics, but a multiracial and cross-generational audience, some of whom even seemed to know the Japanese lyrics. As the show closed to an encore and sea of waving glow sticks, this much was clear. The Tech Meets Pop ethos of Miku wasn't just a virtual hit, she was a real one, too. It was like partying in a concert-sized video game, led by a human-looking hologram who had all the best moves. For The World, I'm Corey Takahashi in Los Angeles.
Bright blue hair and lipstick to match. You can't beat those Hatsune Miku super fans. They're real, too. You can check out the slideshow and videos at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the rest of your 4th of July.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide. Online at plowshares.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Freeman Foundation, and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.